After Tom Cruise's behavior on Oprah and the Today Show, Sumner Redstone, the chairman of Viacom, which owns Paramount Studios, chose not to renew Cruise's deal. "He turned off all women," Redstone explained. "He was embarrassing the studio, and he was costing us a lot of money." Cruise and his longtime producing partner, Paula Wagner, worked out a deal with MGM to resurrect the struggling United Artists studio. Soon after that, Wagner approached Haggis, offering him a very generous deal. He wrote one script for them, a big-budget children's movie, but the studio was so financially pressed that it couldn't afford to produce it. In January 2008, just as it seemed that the derision that was directed at Cruise was about to die down, a video was posted on the internet. It was a taped interview with the star that preceded his acceptance of the Freedom Medal of Valor 4 years earlier. Wearing a black turtleneck with the theme music from Mission Impossible playing in the background, Cruise spoke to Scientologists in language they understood. "Being a Scientologist, you can look at someone and know absolutely that you can help them," Cruise said. "So for me, it really is KSW. And it's something that I don't mince words with anything. But that policy with me has really gone pfst." He made a vigorous gesture. "Boy, there's a time I went through when I said, you know what? When I read it, I just went, poof, that's it. That's exactly it." The video was placed on YouTube and viewed by millions who had no idea what he was talking about. Cruise's urgency came off as the ravings of a wild-eyed fanatic, but to Scientologists, it was a sermon they had heard many times. KSW refers to a policy letter that Hubbard wrote in 1965 titled "Keeping Scientology Working." In the letter, Hubbard reprimanded his followers for straying from the narrow path he had laid out for them. "When somebody enrolls, consider he or she has joined up for the duration of the universe. Never permit an open-minded approach," Hubbard writes. "If they're aboard, they're here on the same terms as the rest of us. Win or die in the attempt." Hubbard concludes, "The whole agonized future of this planet, every man, woman, and child on it, and your own destiny for the next endless trillions of years, depend on what you do here and now with and in Scientology." The church instantly began taking down the video from the internet, threatening lawsuits because of copyright violations. A loose coalition of internet hackers, who called themselves Anonymous, seized on the issue. "We were a bunch of kids who didn't care about anything," Greg Hausch, a computer repair technician in Boston who acts as an unofficial spokesperson for the group, recalled. "Until then, they had never protested anything, but they considered the internet their turf and were offended that the church would attempt to control what they watched. In truth, they knew little about Scientology, but the more they learned, the more aroused they became. We shall proceed to expel you from the internet and systematically dismantle the Church of Scientology in its present form," Anonymous declared in a creepy video of its own. "We are Anonymous. We are Legion. We do not forgive. We do not forget. Expect us." Some members of the Anonymous Coalition waged denial-of-service attacks on church computers, shutting down their websites for an extended period. On February 10, 2008, Anonymous organized protests in front of Scientology churches and missions in 100 cities across the world. Many of the demonstrators were wearing what has now become the signature of the Anonymous movement, the Guy Fawkes mask, taken from the film V for Vendetta. At the center of the controversy was the beleaguered Tom Cruise. An unflattering, unauthorized biography by the British writer Andrew Morton was published days after the YouTube video of Cruise appeared, creating a new round of headlines: Cruise out of control, explosive claims on Cruise baby, German historian likens Cruise speech to Goebbels. that were intensely personal and insulting. Questions of his religion, his sexual orientation, his relationship with his wife, even the paternity of his daughter, were laid out like a banquet for public consumption. Several top executives at United Artists, including Cruise's partner Paula Wagner, decided to leave. Haggis was in his office in Santa Monica when he got a call from Cruise. He hadn't heard a word from him since writing the apology for his wisecrack to Spielberg. Haggis still had his deal at United Artists, which Cruise was running. Now the star had a favor to ask. He wanted to gather a group of top Scientologists in Hollywood, Kirstie Alley, Ann Archer, and Haggis, to go on Oprah or Larry King Live to denounce the attacks on Cruise as religious persecution. Haggis told Cruise that was a terrible idea. He said that Cruise should stop trying to be a mouthpiece for the church and go back to doing what he does best, being a movie star. People love him for that, not for having the answers to all of life's problems. He also advised the star to have a sense of humor about himself, something that is often lacking in Scientology. Instead of constantly going on the attack, he might simply say, "Yeah, I get that it sounds crazy, but it works for me." Footnote. Cruise's attorney, Bertram Fields, denies this took place. Mr. Cruise has never asked Mr. Haggis or anyone else to denounce media attacks on Mr. Cruise on the Larry King Show or anywhere else, or to do anything like that. End footnote. Cruise didn't want to hear what Haggis had to say at the time, but soon after this conversation, he took a wildly comic turn in the Ben Stiller film Tropic Thunder, playing a profane studio executive who reminded a number of Hollywood insiders of Sumner Redstone. He also went back on the Today Show for another interview with Matt Lauer. This time, he was chastened and introspective. "I came across as arrogant," he admitted, when reflecting on their previous interview 3 years earlier. "That's not who I am. That's not the person I am. I'm here to entertain people. That's who I am and what I want to do." Outside the windows of the studio, a crowd of people in the plaza of Rockefeller Center waved and blew kisses. Haggis was casting the next 3 days in the summer of 2009, and he asked Jason Begay to read for the part of a detective. Begay's best-known film role was as the love interest for Demi Moore in G.I. Jane. In the late 90s, when Haggis had worked with the gravel-voiced actor on a CBS series, Family Law, Begay had been an occasional frontman for Scientology. He had come to the church, like so many others, through the Beverly Hills Playhouse. In old promotional materials for the church, Begay is quoted as saying that Scientology is a rocket ride to spiritual freedom. He says that Miscavige once called him the poster boy for Scientology. "I just want you to know I'm no longer in Scientology," Begay told Haggis when he called. "Actually, I'm one of its most outspoken critics. The church would be very unhappy if you hire me." "Nobody tells me who I cast," Haggis responded. But he decided to look at the lengthy video Begay had posted on the internet in which he denounces the church as destructive and a ripoff. Haggis thought the actor had gone over the edge, but he asked if they could talk. The two men met at Patrick's Roadhouse, a pleasantly shabby coffee shop on the Pacific Coast Highway. Begay was calmer than he had been in the video, which he now called a snapshot of me having been out only 3 months. He could see that Haggis was troubled. Even though Begay had renounced the church, he continued to use Scientology when dealing with former members. In his several meetings with Haggis, he employed techniques based on Hubbard's ethics conditions. These range from confusion at the bottom and ascend through treason, enemy, doubt, liability, emergency, and so on, up to power. Each of the conditions has a specific set of steps to follow in order to advance to a higher state. Assuming that Haggis was in the condition of doubt, Begay knew that the proper formula required him to provide information. He told Haggis that in the late 90s, he began having emotional problems. The church prescribed more auditing and coursework. In retrospect, Begay felt that it had done no good. "I was paying money for them to fuck me up," he said, estimating that he had spent as much as $600,000 in the process and nearly $1 million in his 13-year Scientology career. When he finally decided to leave the church, he told Tommy Davis that the church was in a condition of liability to him. Ordinarily, when a Scientologist does something wrong, especially something that might damage the image of the organization, he has to make amends, often in the form of a substantial contribution. But now the situation was reversed, Begay maintained. He proposed that the church buy some property and lease it to him at a negligible rate. "You guys don't have any policies to make up the damage, so I'm doing this for your own good and for mine," he explained to Davis and others, "because I don't have a policy of taking it in the ass." Footnote: the church characterizes this as an attempt at extortion. End footnote. While talking to Haggis, Begay was reluctant to use the word brainwashing, whatever the fuck that is, but he did say that somehow his mind had been taken over. "You have all these thoughts, all these ways of looking at things that are L. Ron Hubbard's," he explained. "You think you're becoming more you, but within that is an implanted thing, which is you, the Scientologist." Haggis was disturbed by Begay's account of what had happened after he left the church. He claimed that none of his Scientology friends would talk to him. His son had been kicked out of school. He was being followed by private investigators and threatened with lawsuits. Perhaps because Haggis had never been as much of a true believer as some members, he didn't nurse the same sense of betrayal. "I didn't feel that some worm had buried itself in my ear, and if you plucked it out, you would find L. Ron Hubbard and his thought," he said. But he did feel that he had been cautioned. "Tommy," Haggis's letter of August 19, 2009, abruptly begins, "as you know, for 10 months now I have been writing to ask you to make a public statement denouncing the actions of the Church of Scientology of San Diego. Their public sponsorship of Proposition 8, which succeeded in taking away the civil rights of gay and lesbian citizens of California, rights that were granted them by the Supreme Court of our state, is a stain on the integrity of our organization and a stain on us personally. Our public association with that hate-filled legislation shames us." The tone of the letter is both aggrieved and outraged. Mixing Haggis's personal experiences with the results of his one-man investigation into the church, he mentions how Katie Haggis's friends had turned against her when she came out to them as a lesbian. Katie had told him that another friend of hers had applied to be the assistant for Jenna and Bodie Elfman, the Scientology acting couple. Lauren Hagney, Tom Cruise's niece in the Sea Org, had been assigned to vet the applicants. Katie says that Lauren wrote up a report saying that Katie's friend was known to hang out with lesbians. The friend did not get the job, Katie said. Footnote: the church forwarded a letter to me from Katie Haggis's friend in which she denies losing a job because of their friendship and asserting that the church is welcoming to everyone, regardless of their sexual orientation. The friend, whose parents are both employed by the church, did not respond to a request to talk further. End footnote. Haggis also recounted the scene at John Travolta and Kelly Preston's house, when another Scientologist made the slur about the gay waiter. "I admire John and Kelly for many reasons. One of them is the way they handled that," Haggis stated. "You and I both know there has been a hidden anti-gay sentiment in the church for a long time. I have been shocked on too many occasions to hear Scientologists make derogatory remarks about gay people and then quote LRH in their defense." He said that the church's decision not to denounce the bigots who supported Proposition 8 was cowardly. "Silence is consent, Tommy. I refuse to consent." He referenced Davis's interview on CNN. "I saw you deny the church's policy of disconnection. You said straight out there was no such policy, that it did not exist," he wrote. "I was shocked. We all know this policy exists. I didn't have to search for verification. I didn't have to look any further than my own home." He reminded Davis of Deborah's experience with her parents. "Although it caused her terrible personal pain, my wife broke off all contact with them. That's not ancient history, Tommy. It was a year ago." He added, "To see you lie so easily, I am afraid to ask myself, what else are you lying about?" Then, he said, he had read the series of articles in the St. Petersburg Times. "They left me dumbstruck and horrified. These were not the claims made by outsiders looking to dig up dirt against us. These accusations were made by top international executives who had devoted most of their lives to the church. Say what you will about them now, these were staunch defenders of the church, including Mike Rinder, the church's official spokesman for 20 years. Tommy, if only a fraction of these accusations are true, we are talking about serious, indefensible human and civil rights violations." He continued, "And when I pictured you assuring me that it is all lies, that this is nothing but an unfounded and vicious attack by a group of disgruntled employees, I am afraid that I saw the same face that looked in the camera and denied the policy of disconnection. I heard the same voice that professed outrage at our support of Proposition 8, who promised to correct it and did nothing. I was left feeling outraged and, frankly, more than a little stupid." Haggis was especially disturbed by the way the church's Freedom magazine had responded to the newspaper's revelations. It included a lengthy, annotated transcript of conversations that had taken place prior to the publication of the series between the Times reporters Joe Childs and Thomas C. Tobin and representatives of the church, including Tommy Davis and Jessica Feshbach, the two international spokespersons for the church. In the Freedom account, the names of the defectors were never actually stated, perhaps to shield Scientologists from the shock of seeing familiar figures such as Marty Rathbun and Amy Scobie publicly denouncing the organization and its leader. Rathbun was called Kingpin and Amy Scobie the adulteress. At one point in the conversation, Davis had told reporters that Scobie had been expelled from the church because she had had an affair. The reporters responded that she had denied any sexual contact outside her marriage. "That's a lie," Davis told them. Feshbach, who carried a stack of documents, then said, "She has a written admission of each one of her instances of extramarital indiscretions. I believe there were 5. When Haggis read this, he immediately assumed that the church had gotten its information from auditing sessions. Footnote: Tommy Davis gave me an affidavit signed by Scobie in which she admits to having liaisons. Scobie told me there were only 2 incidents, both of which involved a kiss and nothing more. She says she did not write the affidavit. She says she only signed it in the hope of leaving the church on good terms so that she could stay in touch with relatives. The church maintains that it does not use confidential information derived from auditing sessions." End footnote. He was inflamed. A priest would go to jail before revealing secrets from the confessional, no matter what the cost to himself or his church, he wrote. "You took Amy Scobie's most intimate admissions about her sexual life and passed them on to the press and then smeared them all over the pages of your newsletter. This is the woman who joined the Sea Org at 16. She ran the entire Celebrity Center network and was a loyal senior executive of the church for, what, 20 years? He added that he was aware that the church might do the same to him. "Well, luckily, I have never held myself up to be anyone's role model." Haggis concluded, "The great majority of Scientologists I know are good people who are genuinely interested in improving conditions on this planet and helping others. I have to believe that if they knew what I now know, they too would be horrified. But I know how easy it was for me to defend our organization and dismiss our critics without ever truly looking at what was being said. I did it for 35 years. I am only ashamed that I waited this many months to act. I hereby resign my membership in the Church of Scientology. At the time Haggis was doing his investigation, the FBI was also looking into Scientology. In December 2009, Tricia Whitehill, a special agent from the Los Angeles office, flew to Florida to interview former members of the church at the Bureau's office in downtown Clearwater, which happens to be directly across the street from Scientology's spiritual headquarters. Tom DeVoogt, who spoke to Whitehill then, got the impression that the investigation had been going on for quite a while. He says that Whitehill confided that she hadn't told the local agents what the investigation was about in case the office had been infiltrated. Amy Scobie also spoke to Whitehill for 2 full days, mainly about the abuse she had witnessed. Whitehill and Valerie Venegas, the lead agent on the case, also interviewed former Sea Org members in California. One was Gary Moorhead, who had developed the blow drill. He explained how his security team would use emotional and psychological pressure to bring escapees back. But failing that, physical force has been used. Footnote: the church denies that blow drills exist. End footnote. Whitehill and Venegas worked on a special task force devoted to human trafficking. The laws regarding trafficking were built largely around forced prostitution, but they also pertain to slave labor. Under federal law, slavery is defined in part by use of coercion, torture, starvation, imprisonment, threats, and psychological abuse. The California Penal Code lists several indicators that someone may be a victim of human trafficking: signs of trauma or fatigue, being afraid or unable to talk because of censorship or security measures that prevent communication with others, working in one place without the freedom to move about, owing a debt to one's employer, and not having control over identification documents. Those conditions resemble the accounts of many former Sea Org members who lived at Gold Base. If proven, those allegations would still be difficult to prosecute given the religious status of Scientology. Mark Headley escaped from Gold Base in 2005. He says this was after being beaten by Miscavige. Footnote: according to Tommy Davis, Mr. Miscavige has never physically assaulted Mark Headley or anyone else. End footnote. His defection was especially painful for the church because Mark says he was the first person Tom Cruise audited. In Scientology, the auditor bears a significant responsibility for the progress of his subject. If you audit somebody and that person leaves the organization, there's only one person whose fault that is: the auditor, Headley explained. Later that year, Mark's wife, Claire, also escaped. In 2009, they sued the church, claiming that the working conditions at Gold Base violated labor and human trafficking laws. The church responded that the Headleys were ministers who had voluntarily submitted to the rigors of their calling, and that the First Amendment protected Scientology's religious practices. The court agreed with this argument and dismissed the Headleys' complaints, awarding the church $40,000 in litigation costs. In April 2010, John Brousseau also fled. He, too, represented a dangerous liability to the church. He had been a Sea Org member for decades. He had worked personally for Hubbard, and he knew Miscavige intimately. But what was of most concern to the church was the fact that he had worked on or overseen numerous special projects for Tom Cruise. None of these unique and costly gifts come anywhere close to the millions of dollars that the star has donated to the church over the years, but they do call into question the private benefit afforded a single individual by a tax-exempt religious organization. Brousseau knew the lengths to which the church would go in order to find him and bring him back. He drove to Carson City, Nevada, and bought a netbook computer at a Walmart, along with an air card, then set up an encrypted email account. He sent a note to Rathbun saying, "I just left, and I'm freaked out, and I've got nowhere to go." Rathbun invited him to South Texas. Expecting that the church would have hired private detectives to stake out key intersections on the interstate highways, Brousseau stuck to county roads. It took him 3 days to make it to Texas. He was driving a black Ford Excursion, much like the one that he had fashioned into a limousine for Cruz. Brousseau and Rathbun met at a Chili's restaurant near Corpus Christi. They decided to hide Brousseau's truck at a friend's house. Rathbun then checked Brousseau into a Best Western motel under a different name. Despite the precautions, 2 days later, at 5:30 in the morning, when Brousseau went out on the balcony to smoke, he heard a door open nearby and footsteps walking toward him. It was Tommy Davis and three other church members. "Hey, J.B.," Davis said, "you got yourself in some shit." Brousseau turned and walked away. "Where are you going?" Davis demanded. Brousseau said he was going to get some coffee. Davis and the Scientology delegation followed behind him. The Circle K across the street wasn't open yet, so Brousseau went into the motel lobby. He told the receptionist, "Call the police. These guys are stalking me." She laughed in disbelief. "We've got a room here, too," Davis said. Brousseau said he needed to go to the bathroom. As soon as he got back to his room, he bolted the door and called Rathbun. "Marty, they came for me," he said. After calling 911, Rathbun jumped in his truck to go to the motel, but four cars filled with Scientologists blocked his way. He says they were led by Michael Doven, Cruz's former personal assistant. Brousseau waited in his room until the police officers arrived. Davis and the others left empty-handed. Footnote: Davis later said that he had never followed a Sea Org member who had blown and had only gone to see Brousseau because he was a very good friend of mine. Deposition of Thomas Davis, Mark Headley v. Church of Scientology International, and Claire Headley v. Church of Scientology International, U.S. District Court, Central District of California, July 2, 2010. End footnote. Brousseau talked to Whitehill and Venegas at the FBI. He was under the impression that the federal agents were considering a raid on Gold Base. Brousseau says he was shown high-resolution photos of the base taken from a drone aircraft. He says he was told that they had even gathered the tail numbers on Tom Cruise's aircraft in case Miscavige tried to escape. Brousseau and others claim to have discouraged the idea, saying that such a raid would turn Miscavige into a martyr, and in any case, no one would testify against him. Rinder told the agents it would be a waste of time, because everyone would tell them their lives are all seashells and butterflies. The investigation was reportedly dropped. Footnote: Valerie Venegas told one of her sources that higher-up officials had spiked it. Later, she blamed me because I had uncovered the probe and had called to verify it with the agents. Tony Ortega, FBI investigation of Scientology, already over before we even heard of it. Village Voice blogs, March 19, 2012. End footnote. After sending copies of his resignation letter to his closest friends in Scientology, Haggis wasn't surprised when he came home from work a few days later to find 9 or 10 of them standing in his front yard. "I can't imagine why you're here," he joked, but he invited them to sit on the back porch and talk. Ann Archer and her husband, Terry Jastrow, an Emmy-winning producer for ABC Sports, were there. Mark Isham, a composer who worked with Haggis for years, came with his wife, Donna. Sky Dayton, the founder of Earthlink and Boingo Wireless, joined them, along with several other friends and a representative of the church that Haggis didn't know. His friends could have served as an advertisement for Scientology. They were wealthy, high achievers with solid marriages who exuded a sense of spiritual well-being. Scientologists are trained to believe in their persuasive powers and the need to keep a positive frame of mind. But the mood on Haggis's porch was downbeat, and his friends' questions were full of reproach. "Do you have any idea that this might damage a lot of wonderful Scientologists?" Jastro asked. "It's such a betrayal of our group." Haggis responded that he didn't mean to be critical of Scientology. "I love Scientology," he said. Everyone knew about Haggis's financial support of the church and the occasions when he had spoken out in its defense. He reminded his friends that he had been with them at the Portland Crusade when he had been drafted to write speeches. Archer had a particular reason to feel aggrieved. Haggis's letter had called her son a liar. She could understand the pain and anger Haggis felt over the treatment of his own gay daughters, but she didn't think that was relevant. In her opinion, homosexuality is not the church's issue. She had personally introduced gay friends to Scientology. Isham was especially frustrated. He felt that they weren't breaking through to Haggis. Of all the friends present, Isham was the closest to Haggis. They had a common artistic sensibility that made it easy to work together. Isham had won an Emmy for the theme music he composed for Haggis's 1996 television series Easy Streets. He had scored Crash and Haggis's last movie, The Valley of Ella. Soon he was supposed to start work on The Next 3 Days. Now both their friendship and their professional relationship were at risk. Isham had been analyzing the discussion from a Scientological perspective. In his view, Haggis's emotional state on the tone scale at that moment was a 1.1, covertly hostile. By adopting a tone just above it, anger, he hoped to blast Haggis out of the psychic place where he seemed to be lodged. Isham made what he calls an intellectual decision to be angry. "Paul, I'm pissed off," he told Haggis. "There are better ways to do this. If you have a complaint, there's a complaint line." Anyone who genuinely wanted to change Scientology should stay within the organization, Isham argued, not quit. All of his friends believed that if he wanted to change Scientology, he should do it from within. They wanted him to recant and return to the fold, or else withdraw his letter and walk away without making a fuss. Haggis listened patiently. A fundamental tenet of Scientology is that differing points of view must be fully heard and acknowledged. But when his friends finished, they were still red-faced and angry. Haggis suggested that as good Scientologists, they should at least examine the evidence. He referred them to the St. Petersburg Times articles that had so shaken him, and to certain websites written by former members. He explained that his quarrel was with the management and the culture of the church, not with Scientology itself. By copying them on his resignation letter, he had hoped that they would be as horrified as he by the practices that were going on in the name of Scientology. Instead, he realized they were mainly appalled by his actions in calling the management of the church to account. Haggis's friends came away from the meeting with mixed feelings. "No clearer than when we went in," Archer felt. What wasn't said in this meeting was that this would be the last time any of them would ever speak to Haggis. Isham did consider Haggis's plea to look at the websites or the articles in the St. Petersburg Times, but he decided it was like reading Mein Kampf if you wanted to know something about the Jewish religion. After that first meeting with friends on his back porch, Haggis had several lengthy encounters with Tommy Davis and other representatives of the church. They showed up at his office in Santa Monica, a low-slung brick building on Broadway covered in graffiti like a gang headquarters. The officials brought thick files to discredit people they heard or assumed he had been talking to. This was August 2009. Shooting for The Next 3 Days in Pittsburgh was going to start within days and the office desperately needed Haggis's attention. His producing partner, Michael Nozick, who is not a Scientologist, was frustrated. Haggis was spending hours, day after day, dealing with Scientology delegations. He resorted to getting members of his staff to walk him out to his car because he knew that Scientology executives would be waiting for him, and he wanted to give the impression he was too busy to speak, which he was. But then he would give up and let them into the office for another lengthy confrontation. During one of these meetings, Davis showed Haggis a policy letter that Hubbard had written listing the acts for which one could be declared a suppressive person. Haggis had stepped over the line on four of them. "Tommy, you are absolutely right. I did all those things," Haggis responded. "If you want to call me that, that's what I am." "We can still put this genie back in the bottle," Tommy assured him, but it would mean that Haggis would withdraw the letter and then resign quietly. Although Haggis listened, he didn't change his mind. It seemed to him that the Scientology officials became more livid and irrational the longer they talked. For instance, Davis and the other church officials insisted that Miscavige had not beaten his employees. His accusers, they said, had committed the violence. "Whoa, whoa, whoa," Haggis responded. "Okay, let's say that's true. Miscavige never touched anyone. I'm sorry, but if someone in my organization were going around beating people, I'd know about it. You think I'd put up with it? And I'm not that good a person." Haggis noted that if the rumors about Miscavige's violent temper were true, it just proved that even the greatest leaders are fallible. "Look at Martin Luther King Jr.," he said, referring to one of his heroes. "If you look at his personal life, it's been said he has a few problems in that area." "How dare you compare Dave Miscavige with Martin Luther King?" one of the officials shouted. Haggis was aghast. They thought that comparing Miscavige to Martin Luther King was debasing his character, he said. "If they were trying to convince me that Scientology was not a cult, they did a very poor job of it." Footnote. Tommy Davis says that Martin Luther King Jr.'s name never came up. End footnote. Copies of Haggis's email resignation letter were forwarded to various members of the church, although few outside of church circles knew about it. By October, the letter had found its way to Marty Rathbun. He had become an informal spokesperson for Scientology defectors, who, like him, believed that the church had broken away from Hubbard's original teachings. He called Haggis, who was shooting in Pittsburgh, and asked if he could publish the letter on his blog. "You're a journalist. You don't need my permission," Haggis said, although he did ask him to excise the portion of the letter that dealt with his dinner with John Travolta and Kelly Preston, and the part about his daughter Katie's homosexuality. Haggis didn't think about the consequences of his decision. He thought it would show up on a couple of websites. He was a writer, not a movie star. But Rathbun got 55,000 hits on his blog that afternoon. The next morning, the story was in newspapers around the world. Haggis got a call from Tommy Davis. "Paul, what the hell?" Chapter 11. Tommy. When I first contacted Davis in April 2010, asking for his cooperation on a profile I was writing about Haggis for The New Yorker, he expressed a reluctance to talk, saying that he had already spent a month responding to similar queries. "It made little difference," he said. "The last thing I'm interested in is dredging all this up again." He kept putting me off, saying that he was too busy to get together, although he promised that we would meet when he was more available. "I want our time to be undistracted," he explained in an email. "We should plan on spending at least a full day together, as there is a lot I would want to show you." We finally arranged to meet on Memorial Day weekend. I flew to Los Angeles and spent much of that weekend waiting for him to call. On Sunday, at 3 o'clock, Davis appeared at my hotel with Jessica Feshbach. We sat at a table on the patio. Davis has his mother's sleepy eyes. His thick black hair was combed forward, with a lock falling boyishly onto his forehead. He wore a wheat-colored suit with a blue shirt that opened onto a chest that seemed, among the sun worshippers at the pool, strikingly pallid. Feshback, a slender, attractive woman, anxiously twirled her hair. Davis now told me that he was not willing to participate in or contribute to an article about Scientology through the lens of Paul Haggis. I had come to Los Angeles specifically to talk to him at a time he had chosen. I wondered aloud if he had been told not to talk to me. He said no. "Maybe Paul shouldn't have posted the letter on the Internet," Feshback interjected. "There are all sorts of shoulda, woulda, coulda." She said that she had just spoken to Mark Isham, the composer, whom I had interviewed. "He talked to you about what are supposed to be our confidential scriptures." That I would ask about the church's secret doctrines was offensive, she said. "It's a two-way street happening," she concluded. Footnote. In my meeting with Isham, he had asserted that Scientology is not a faith-based religion. Leaving aside the question of what religion is without faith, I pointed out that in Scientology's upper levels, there was a cosmology that would have to be accepted on faith. Isham responded that he wasn't going to discuss the details of OT3, nor had I asked him to. "You understand the only reason it's confidential is because in the wrong hands it can hurt people," he told me, evidently referring to Hubbard's warning that those who are not spiritually prepared to receive the information would die of pneumonia. End footnote. "Everything I have to say about Paul I've already said," Davis declared. He agreed to respond to fact-checking queries, however. The garden behind Ann Archer and Terry Jastrow's home in the Brentwood neighborhood of Los Angeles is a peaceful retreat filled with olive trees and hummingbirds. A fountain gurgles beside the swimming pool. Jastrow was recounting his first meeting with Archer in Milton Katselis's class. His friend David Ladd, son of the Hollywood legend Alan Ladd, had invited him to visit. "I saw this girl sitting next to Milton," Jastrow recalled. "I said, 'Who's that?'" Archer smiled. There was a cool wind blowing in from the Pacific, and she drew a shawl around her. "We were friends for about a year and a half before we had our first date," she said. They were married in 1978. "Our relationship really works," Jastrow said. "We attribute that essentially 100% to applying Scientology." The two spoke of the techniques that had helped them, such as never being critical of the other and never interrupting. "Scientology isn't a creed," Archer said. "These are basic natural laws of life." She described L. Ron Hubbard as an engineer, not a faith healer, who had codified human emotional states in order to guide the adept to higher levels of existence, to help a guy rise up the tone scale and feel a zest and a love for life. Jastrow had been an acolyte in an Episcopal church when he was studying at the University of Houston, but doubts overwhelmed him. "I walked out in the middle of communion," he said. "I was an atheist for 10 years. That was the condition I was in when I started at the Beverly Hills Playhouse." He had never heard of Scientology at the time. Archer said that the controversy that continually surrounds the church hadn't touched her. "It's not that I'm not aware of it." She added that Scientology is growing, despite the public criticism. "It's in 165 countries. "Translated into 50 languages, Jastrow interjected. "It's the fastest-growing religion. In his opinion, Scientologists do more good things for more people in more places around the world than any other organization ever." He added, "When you study historical perspective of new faiths, they've all been attacked," said Archer. "Look at what happened to the Christians," Jastrow said simultaneously. "Think of the Mormons and the Christian Scientists." They talked about the church's focus on celebrities. Hubbard recognized that if you really want to inspire a culture to have peace and greatness and harmony among men, you need to respect and help the artist to prosper and flourish, Archer said. And if he's particularly well known, he needs a place where he can be comfortable. So celebrity centers provide that. She blamed the press for concentrating too much on Scientology celebrities. Journalists, she said, don't write about the hundreds of thousands of other Scientologists. Millions! Millions of other Scientologists. They only write about 4 friggin' people. Jastrow suggested that Scientology's critics often had a vested interest. He pointed to psychiatrists, psychologists, doctors, drug makers, pharmacies. All those people who make a living and profit and pay their mortgages and pay their college educations and buy their cars, etc., etc., based on people not being well. Who advertise in the newspapers and on television more than any other advertisers, Archer added. But this is a collateral issue, darling, in terms of what I'm talking about, Jastrow continued. For the first time in America's experience with war, there are more mental illnesses from Iraq and Afghanistan than physical illnesses, he said, citing a recent article in USA Today. So mental illnesses become a big business. Drugs merely mask mental distress, he said, whereas Scientology will solve the source of the problem. The medical and pharmaceutical industries are prime funders and sponsors of the media, he said, and therefore might exert influence on people telling the whole and true story about Scientology just because of the profit motive. He said that only Scientology could help mankind right itself. What else is there that we can hang our hopes on? That's improving civilization, Archer added. Is there some other religion on the horizon that's going to help mankind? Jastrow asked. Just tell me where. If not Scientology, where? Ann Archer began studying with Katselas in 1974, 2 years after her son, Tommy Davis, was born. She was the exceptionally beautiful daughter of 2 successful actors. Her father, John Archer, was best known during the 1930s and 1940s as the voice introducing the radio drama The Shadow. Who knows what evil lurks in the hearts of men? The Shadow knows, he said at the beginning of the program. He went on to appear in more than 50 films. Her mother, Marjorie Lord, played Danny Thomas's wife on the popular television show Make Room for Daddy. With such a bloodline, it might be expected that Archer would be aiming toward stardom, but when she entered the Beverly Hills Playhouse, she was coming off a television series, Bob and Carol and Ted and Alice, that she didn't respect and that had been canceled after a single season. She was a young mother in a dissolving marriage, and an actor with diminishing career prospects. Katselas had a transformative effect. Like so many others, Archer was magnetized by this ebullient Greek with his magnificent beard and his badgering, teasing, encouraging, and infuriating personality. He was one of the most inspiring people Archer had ever met. Where had he acquired such wisdom? Some of the other students told her that Katselas was a Scientologist, so she decided to try it out. She began going 2 or 3 times a week to the Celebrity Center to take the Life Repair Program. I remember walking out of the building and walking down the street toward my car, and I felt like my feet were not touching the ground. I said to myself, "My God, this is the happiest I've ever been in my entire life. I've finally found something that works." She added, "Life didn't seem so hard anymore. I was back in the driver's seat." When Tommy was old enough, Archer would bring him to the playhouse while she was taking lessons. He would wander around the theater, venturing into the light booth and watching his mother learning her craft. Jastrow recalled being struck by Tommy's poise even as a 5-year-old child. "I am a really good dad, and he taught me how," Jastrow said. He gave the example of a visit from his own parents, who had flown out from Midland, Texas, to meet Terry's new family. After Jastrow had driven them back to the airport, Tommy said, "I noticed that your dad was pretty strict with you." Jastrow agreed that his father had been very stern when he was growing up. Then Tommy continued, "I was noticing that you're pretty strict with me." Jastrow pointed to that as a defining moment in their relationship. "I realized I wanted to be his friend first," he said. He was the senior being in that relationship. Anne and Terry soon found their way into Scientology, but Tommy was initially raised in his mother's original faith, Christian Science. His father, William Davis, is a wealthy financier and real estate developer who was once reported to be among the largest owners of agricultural property in California. He was also a well-known fundraiser for Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush and personally contributed an estimated $350,000 a year to Republican causes. Although Tommy grew up in an environment of money and celebrity, he impressed people with his modesty. He longed to do something to help humanity. Scientology seemed to offer a direction. Paul Haggis met Tommy at the Celebrity Center in 1989 when he was 17 years old, a sweet and bright boy. Their meeting came at a critical moment in Tommy's life. He had just broken up with his girlfriend. Archer had taken him to the Celebrity Center for counseling, where he took a course called Personal Values and Integrity. Tommy's presence immediately caused a stir inside the church. The president of the Celebrity Center, Karen Hollander, fixed on the idea that Tommy should be her personal assistant. He was young, very rich, and handsome enough to be a movie star himself. He had grown up mixing with famous people. It would be a perfect fit. Whenever celebrities came in, there would be Ann Archer's son. But that required coaxing Tommy to join the Sea Org. Hollander called in the younger members of her staff to woo him. "You can either go to college and get a WOG education, or you can join Sea Org and be doing the best service you could ever do for mankind, and for yourself," John Peeler, Hollander's secretary at the time, would tell him. Although Anne and Terry say they wanted Tommy to get a college education, they knew of the efforts to recruit him and didn't stand in the way. That fall, Tommy entered Columbia University, but lasted only a single semester. Over Christmas break, he went back into Hollander's office, and when he came out, he excitedly told Peeler he had just signed the billion-year contract. His job for Hollander was to attend to the celebrities who lounged around the president's office. Lisa Marie Presley was often there, as were Kirstie Alley and writer-director Floyd Muttrow. John Travolta would drop by occasionally. Also in this crowd was a clique of young actors who had grown up in the church, including Giovanni Ribisi and his sister Marissa, Jenna Elfman, and Juliet Lewis. Davis would arrange for them all to go to movies together. He was charming, attractive, he had a great sense of humor, and eventually David Miscavige began to notice. Miscavige liked the fact that he was young and looked trendy and wore Brioni or Armani suits, Mike Rinder observed. He had a cute BMW. It was an image that Miscavige liked. Davis moved into Sea Org berthing in a dodgy neighborhood on Wilcox Street in West Hollywood. It was quite a step down from the luxurious life he had enjoyed until then. He was quickly introduced to some of the inner secrets of the organization. In about 1994, he was involved in an embarrassing cover-up when a well-known spokesperson for the church was captured in a video having sex with several other men. Amy Scobie says that church executives were frantic that their spokesperson would be exposed as being gay. Scobie and Karen Hollander set a briefcase with the spokesperson's auditing files in the back seat of the car that Hollander was borrowing at the time, actually Tommy Davis's BMW, intending to take the files to Gold Base the next day for senior managers to review. Because the car was in a highly secure parking lot, they thought nothing of it. Davis returned late that night, however. He found his car and decided to take it back to the Sea Org dormitory. When he parked the car on Wilcox Street, he happened to notice the briefcase, so he locked it in the trunk and went to bed. The next day, Scobie got a call from a sheepish Davis. He said that someone had broken into his car and stolen the briefcase out of the trunk. "When we told Tommy what was in the briefcase, he freaked," Scobie recalled. "He went around for a week searching through dumpsters. Finally, someone approached Davis about the reward he had offered and led him to the thief, a homeless man who was trying to sell the briefcase. The contents, which were still in it, meant nothing to him. Davis gave the man $20. Footnote: the church denies that this ever happened. Davis admits that the briefcase was lost, but claims that there were no sex-related videos inside. End footnote. Davis was disappointed because the search forced him to miss the ceremony where John Travolta was awarded a Scientology medal. Davis went through a period of doubt and actually considered dropping out of the Sea Org, according to Scobie. But then he recommitted and became so enthusiastic that he had the Sea Org logo, a laurel wreath with 26 leaves representing the stars in the Galactic Confederacy, tattooed on his arm. When Miscavige found out, he berated Davis, saying that he had violated the church's copyright. Davis began working with Marty Rathbun during his intensive auditing of Cruise. When Rathbun was thrown in the hole, Davis became something more than a gopher for the star. He provided a line to Cruise at a time when the actor's relationship with the church was not yet solidified, and his constant presence beside the superstar boosted the image of Scientology as a hip, insider network. Although Cruise is 10 years older, the two men physically resemble each other, with long faces and strong jaws, a likeness that is enhanced by similar spiky haircuts. Their relationship evolved into a friendship, but one that reflected the immense power imbalance between them, as well as Davis's position as a deputy of the church in the service of its most precious asset. Until his association with Cruise, Davis had been called Tom, but he became Tommy to distinguish him from the star. In other ways, he became more like him: his clothes, his hair, his intensity. At the age of 19, Davis married a dreamy Belgian woman, Nadine Van Houtigem, who was also in the Sea Org. "I made the decision to forward the aims of Scientology," she told the ABC News program 2020 in 1998. "I actually compare it a little bit like Mother Teresa." She added, "It's a fun activity to set men free." According to Mike Rinder, Nadine Davis became intensely involved in Tom Cruise's entourage. "Somehow dealing with Katie Holmes, she did something wrong," Rinder says. "She became a non-person." He says that Tommy was forced to divorce her. Footnote: Davis says that he and his wife divorced because of irreconcilable differences and that it had nothing to do with the organization. End of footnote. Soon after Cruise's troubles in 2005, Tommy Davis was sent to Clearwater to participate in the Estates Project Force. Normally, the EPF functions as a kind of boot camp for new Sea Org members. Donna Shannon was a veterinarian who had risen to OT-7 before signing her billion-year contract. She was surprised to find that about half the people undergoing training were veteran Sea Org members who were being disciplined, including Davis. He seemed like a nice guy, so she was puzzled that he was subjected to the worst hazing. "He complained about being out scrubbing the dumpster with a toothbrush till late at night," she recalled. "Then he'd be up at 6 to do our laundry." Sometimes Davis would be paraded in front of the other Sea Org members as his ethics officer shouted, "This guy is not a big shot. He's lying to you." Only later did Shannon learn that Davis was Ann Archer's son. As it happens, Archer was also at the Clearwater base taking advanced courses. A teenage Sea Org member, Daniel Montalvo, the same one who guarded Cruz during his auditing sessions, was assigned to keep her in the dark and make sure that she never encountered her son. Shannon and Davis worked together, maintaining the grounds. "I was supposedly supervising him," Shannon said. "I was told to make him work really hard." That didn't seem to be a problem for Davis. At one point, Shannon said he borrowed about $100 from her because he didn't have money for food. One day, Shannon and Davis were taking the bus to a work project. Shannon asked why he was in the EPF. "I got busted," Davis told her. "I fucked up on Tom Cruise's lines," meaning that he had botched a project Cruise was involved in. "So what are your plans now?" she asked. "I just want to do my stuff and get back on post," Davis replied. Shannon said that suddenly, it was like a veil went over his eyes, and he goes, "I already said too much." Several months later, Davis paid her back the money. Footnote: Davis says that he does not recall meeting Shannon, has never scrubbed a dumpster, and has no need to borrow money. End footnote. When Davis finished the EPF, he replaced Rinder as chief spokesperson for the church because Rinder was confined to the hole. One of his first assignments was to deal with John Sweeney, an aggressive reporter for the BBC, who was doing a story on Scientology and had been working with Rinder until then. Davis made the mistake of admitting to Sweeney that he reported to Miscavige every day, spoiling the illusion of the leader as being unavailable and above the fray. Miscavige pulled Rinder out of the hole and ordered him to help Davis deal with the BBC, although he added, "You're Tommy Davis's servant." Sweeney immediately sensed that Rinder had been demoted. Rinder was gaunt, hollow-eyed, strange with a hint of niceness. Tommy was now the top dog, gleaming teeth, snappily suited, charming but creepily so. When Sweeney refused to accede to the church's restrictions, mainly that he agree not to use the word cult in his report, and began independently reporting on the accusations of defectors, he was shadowed by private investigators. A Scientology film crew showed up to document the making of the BBC documentary. Cameras were pointed at cameras. Davis appeared unannounced at Sweeney's hotel and even traveled across the country to disrupt his interviews with Scientology dissidents. Sweeney had covered wars in Afghanistan, Bosnia, and Chechnya, but he had never had such emotional and psychological pressure placed upon him. During these confrontations, Rinder trailed behind Davis, staring blankly into space as Davis goaded the reporter inches from his face. When Sweeney suggested that Scientology is a sadistic cult, Davis, wearing sunglasses, checked with his cameraman to see that the camcorder was running, then said, "Now listen to me for a second. You have no right to say what is and what isn't a religion. The Constitution of the United States of America guarantees one's right to practice and believe freely in this country. And the definition of religion is very clear, and it's not defined by John Sweeney. For you to repeatedly refer to my faith in those terms is so derogatory and so offensive and so bigoted. And the reason you kept repeating it is because you wanted a reaction like you're getting right now. Well, buddy, you got it. Right here, right now, I'm angry, real angry." Davis turned and walked away, trailed by Sweeney, who protested, "It's your turn to listen to me. I'm a British subject." Another confrontation took place at the Psychiatry and Industry of Death exhibit in Hollywood. Davis once again moved in, nose to nose with Sweeney. "You're accusing members of my religion of brainwashing." He was referring to an earlier interview Sweeney had conducted with another Scientologist. "No, Tommy," Sweeney responded, his voice rising. "You were not there. Brainwashing is a crime," Davis said. "Listen to me. You were not there. At the beginning of the interview," Sweeney shouted in an oddly slow cadence, "you did not hear or record The interview. Do you understand that brainwashing is a crime? Davis said, unfazed by Sweeney's enraged screams. Davis's composure and his spirited defense of his church made quite a contrast with the sputtering and eventually deeply chagrined reporter, who apologized to BBC viewers on the air. In March 2007, John Travolta's new movie, Wild Hogs, a comedy about two middle-aged men who decide to become bikers, was scheduled to open in Britain. Concerned that Sweeney would confront Travolta during the publicity for the film, Rinder and Davis planned to travel together to London, but on the day of departure, Davis failed to show up. Someone went to his room, but he was nowhere to be found. Rinder had to travel to London alone. He learned from Miscavige's communicator that Davis had blown. Sweeney immediately sensed that something was up and kept pestering Rinder about where Davis was. Rinder told him Davis had the flu. As part of the film promotion, Travolta arrived at the red carpet London premiere on a motorcycle. Sweeney was standing in the crowd in Leicester Square, well away from the star, crying out, "Are you a member of a sinister, brainwashing cult?" Travolta's fans shouted Sweeney down. Later, Sweeney asked Rinder if it was true that Miscavige had beaten him, claiming to have an eyewitness. "Who's the witness?" Rinder asked. "He wishes to remain confidential because he says he is scared." "John, that is typical of what you do," Rinder said. "He says that David Miscavige knocked you to the ground. Absolute rubbish, 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 not true, rubbish." Rinder threatened to sue if Sweeney aired such allegations. When the BBC program ran, there was no mention of physical abuse. Rinder felt that he had spared the church considerable embarrassment. But far from being grateful, Miscavige told him that Sweeney's piece should never have run at all. He ordered Rinder to report to an RPF facility in England. Rinder decided he'd had enough. He blew. Davis called the church and returned voluntarily from Las Vegas, where he had been hiding. Footnote: Davis denies that he blew or was in Las Vegas. Noriyuki Matsumaru, who was a finance officer in the Religious Technology Center at the time, told me he was in charge of handling Davis's punishment when he returned. End of footnote. He was sent to Clearwater, where he was security checked by Jessica Feshback. The aim of the check is to gain a confession using an e-meter. It can function as a powerful form of thought control. Davis and Feshback subsequently married. On a rainy morning in late September 2010, I finally got my meeting with Tommy Davis. The profile of Paul Haggis I had been preparing was nearing publication. Davis and Feshback, along with four attorneys representing the church, traveled to Manhattan to meet with me. My editor, Daniel Zalewski, and David Remnick, the editor of The New Yorker, the two lead fact-checkers on the story, Jennifer Stahl and Tim Farrington, as well as the head of the magazine's fact-checking department, Peter Canby, and our lawyer, Lynn Oberlander. Leading the Scientology legal delegation was Anthony Michael Glassman, a former assistant U.S. attorney who now has a boutique law firm in Beverly Hills specializing in representing movie stars. On his website, he boasts of a $10 million judgment against the New York Times. The stakes were obvious to everyone. The Scientology delegation brought with them 48 three-ring binders of supporting material, stretching nearly 7 linear feet, to respond to the 971 questions the checkers had posed. It was an impressive display. The binders were labeled according to categories, such as Disappearance of L. Ron Hubbard, Tom Cruise, Gold Base, and Haggis's Involvement in Scientology. Davis emphasized that the church had gone to extraordinary lengths to prepare for this meeting. "Frankly, the only thing I can think that compares would be the presentation that we made in the early 1990s to the IRS," We sat around a large, blonde conference table with the kaleidoscopic lights of Times Square garishly whirling in the background. I particularly recall the Dunkin' Donuts sign over Davis's shoulder as he began his presentation. First, he ruled out any discussion of the church's confidential scripture. He compared it to shoving an image of the prophet Muhammad in the face of a Muslim, or insisting that a Jew eat pork. He then attacked the credibility of some of the sources for the piece, whom he called bitter apostates. "They are unreliable," he said. "They make up stories." He produced a paper by Brian Wilson, who was an eminent Oxford sociologist and prominent defender of new religious movements. He died in 2004. Wilson argues that testimony from disaffected members should be treated skeptically, noting, "The apostate is generally in need of self-justification. He seeks to reconstruct his own past, to excuse his former affiliations, and to blame those who were formerly his closest associates. He is likely to be suggestible and ready to enlarge or embellish his grievances to satisfy that species of journalist whose interest is more in sensational copy than in an objective statement of the truth." Davis had highlighted the last part for my benefit. As an example, Davis singled out Gerald Armstrong, the former Scientology archivist who received an $800,000 settlement in a fraud suit against the church in 1986. Davis charged that Armstrong had forged many of the documents that he later disseminated in order to discredit the church's founder, although he produced no evidence to substantiate that allegation. He passed around a photograph of Armstrong, which, he said, showed Armstrong sitting naked with a giant globe in his lap. This was a photo that was in a newspaper article he did where he said that all people should give up money, Davis said. He's not a very sane person. Footnote: Armstrong told me that he was actually wearing running shorts in the photo, which were obscured by the globe. His settlement with the church prohibited him from talking about Scientology, a prohibition he has ignored, and the church has won two breach of contract suits against him, including a $500,000 judgment in 2004, which Armstrong didn't pay. He gave away most of his money and continues to speak openly about the church. End footnote. Davis also displayed photographs of what he said were bruises sustained by Mike Rinder's former wife in 2010 after Rinder physically assaulted her in a Florida parking lot. Footnote: Rinder denies committing violence against his wife. A sheriff's report supports this. End footnote. Davis then showed a mugshot of Marty Rathbun in a jailhouse jumpsuit after being detained in New Orleans in July 2010 for public drunkenness. "Getting arrested for being drunk on the intersection of Bourbon and Toulouse?" Davis cracked. "That's like getting arrested for being a leper in a leper colony." Other defectors, such as Claire and Mark Headley, were the most despicable people in the world. Jefferson Hawkins was an inveterate liar. If these people were so reprehensible, I asked, how had they all arrived at such elevated positions in the church? "They weren't like that when they were in those positions," Davis replied. The defectors we were discussing had not only risen to positions of responsibility within the church, they had also ascended Scientology's ladder of spiritual accomplishment. I suggested that Scientology didn't seem to be effective if people at the highest levels of spiritual attainment were actually liars, adulterers, wife-beaters, drunks, and embezzlers. "This is a religion," Davis responded movingly. "It aspires to greatness, hope, humanity, spiritual freedom, to be greater than we are, to rise above our craven humanoid instincts." "Scientology doesn't pretend to be perfect," he said, "and it shouldn't be judged on the misconduct of a few apostates." "I haven't done things like that," Davis said. "I haven't suborned perjury, destroyed evidence, lied, contrary to what Paul Haggis says." He spoke of his frustration with Haggis after his resignation. If he was so troubled and shaken on the fundamentals of Scientology, then why the hell did he stick around for 35 years? He continued, did he stay a closet Scientologist for some career advancement purpose? Davis shook his head in disgust. I think he's the most hypocritical person in the world. He said he felt that he'd done all he could in dealing with Haggis over the issue of Proposition 8. He added that the individual who had made the mistake of listing the San Diego Church as a supporter of the initiative, he didn't divulge his name, had been disciplined for it. I asked what that meant. He was sat down by a staff member of the local organization, Davis explained. He got sorted out. Davis thought I was making too much out of the issue of suppressive persons in the piece. Do you know how many people, grand total, there are in the world who have been declared suppressive? He asked rhetorically. A couple of thousand over the years, at most. He said that, in fact, many had been restored to good standing. Yet again, you're falling into the trap of defining our religion by the people who've left.